Hello, this is Victor Perton, That Optimism Man, and welcome to That Optimism Man podcast at the Centre for Optimism. Today, I am delighted to welcome a truly inspiring guest, Dr. Stephen Parnas. Stephen is an emergency physician, a renowned advocate for healthcare professionals in Australia and beyond, a public voice in ethics and leadership, and someone who has navigated the highest pressure environments with extraordinary insight and resilience. In this episode, we'll explore profound topics that touch the very heart of optimism, its life and death significance in healthcare, the lessons from leadership under pressure, and how optimism shapes our responses to crisis and burnout. Dr. Parnas has lived these lessons firsthand, and his story will leave you enriched, inspired, and thinking deeply about the role of optimism in life and work. So, Stephen, welcome to That Optimism Man podcast at the Centre for Optimism.
Thank you very much, Victor. It's a pleasure to be here.
As you know, the first question we always ask someone visiting the Centre for Optimism is, what makes you optimistic? Is it shaped by your experiences as a physician, your mindset, your faith, or the people you've worked with?
I think it's all of the above, and all of those things, when you reflect on them, give cause for gratitude. I feel myself blessed with all sorts of gifts, everything from the people who have been a part of my life through to the experiences I've had. And look, even I dare say, some of the adversity I've experienced in my life, while I wouldn't go looking for it, they have been some wonderful learning opportunities, and they have helped me to really savour and appreciate what I have in my life, and to try and really recognise just how wonderful those things can be for me.
Yeah, gratitude is such a powerful underpinning for optimism. In my own family, they were refugees. They came to Australia with nothing. And, you know, the gratitude for the life we live was a very powerful underpinning for their lives.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I summarise a lot of the things that I feel about the way I try and live my life in my experience I've had with either illness as a patient or as a relative of a patient, and I think that's made me a better doctor. So that's the example where adversity, difficulty has often turned to good in ways that I'd least expected.
Yeah, and a very powerful, I mean, Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, his subsequent essay, Tragic Optimism, that notion of doing your best in whatever circumstances you're in. And you've got a remarkable career because you're an emergency physician, you're a public spokesman for the medical profession, you work in ethics with students and practitioners. So just could you share a little bit of your life journey that has brought to you to these positions of leadership and public trust?
Well, I'm 55 years old now, and I was born in Sunshine in Melbourne's West. I had, if you like, the experience of growing up in a village. West Sunshine had a strong Maltese community, many migrants. My dad was a migrant. I had a very big extended family, and the vast majority of them lived within 1 or 2 kilometres. And so that idea of being around them was incredibly special to me. I was myself without any pretense as a kid, and looking back on the way that my family, my teachers, my friends spoke to me, it seemed that I had aptitude for study and passion about all sorts of various interests, for things in the community, for example. And if I look back on my life, that's where I've tended to stand out. I've done well in my studies at all levels of education. I've manifested those interests in the way I do things. Being a doctor hasn't just been about treating patients in front of me. It's been about leadership roles, even in the Medical Student Society at uni, Melbourne Uni Student Union, the AMA, and I did that for many years. And then, even in my own right, over the course of my career after the AMA, talking on issues that I felt mattered. The ones that stand out would be when there were debates here initially in Victoria and subsequently around the country about euthanasia, the way we treat people at the end of life. Again, during the pandemic, my view was sought quite frequently about, how do you, Steve, interpret this dramatic, unexpected disaster in some ways that happened to us as a community? And all I could do was what I usually do, which is share my experiences, my stories, what I believed to be important, and what I would encourage people to do, that idea of trying to share adversity together to understand why we do things and why we did hard things, to stand up against adversity, because it's always been the case that if you say something of significance, there's inevitably going to be some opposition or pushback, and it's how you deal with that. And I think we're in a world where it's very easy for expertise, truth, facts to be discarded, or for the ad hominem attack, for people to be attacked as an individual rather than a focus on the issue. So I try to meet hostility with a degree of, I suppose, empathy, try and focus on the issue. Maybe I don't get it right all the time, but that's the approach I try to take. And, the other one that comes to mind was I had a significant period of burnout after the worst of the pandemic, and I spoke about it deliberately and publicly because I wanted people to understand that people, even at my level of seniority, were subject to this, how to understand it, and to really give permission to my colleagues, senior or junior, to make their own health and well-being a big priority, because if they look after themselves, they're going to be better at looking after other people. So I hope that's a bit of a summary of much of my professional journey, and it'll be interesting to see where the next decade takes me if I'm given it.
Oh, the next 5 decades. When I teach public policy, I often use Henry Kissinger as my example. So at 99, his views and his wisdom were very much sought after. So as I read about you, I think at 55, you've got a great deal of wisdom as well as experience.
I've always aspired, and it's for others to judge whether I've got that wisdom. The aphorism, knowledge without wisdom is dangerous, wisdom without knowledge is useless. You've got to have both. And that wisdom is important because it allows you to understand the other side or the other recipient and participant in dialogue. It helps you understand timing. And it helps you understand when to repeat, when to make emphasis, and when to hold back or when to go full throttle on things. And that's something where experience, and curiosity make a big, big difference, I think.
One of my board members is John Hagel, and he not only talks about curiosity, but he talks about the journey of the explorer. And I certainly get that impression that you're not just curious, you're creating new knowledge almost on a weekly basis.
Look, I don't know about that. I've always regarded myself as being skilled at recognizing good ideas. I'm on a couple of company boards. In my hospital work, I spend a lot of time nurturing younger and senior doctors to move to their next steps as leaders. And I think I can see the big picture with a bit more ease than some others, maybe. But I don't know how creative I am with that stuff. I think, but I'd like to think I'm good at seeing those ideas in others and encouraging them to do it. And being able to separate ego from things as well, because I think you get to a certain point in life, you see through flattery, you see through the empty plaudits, you hopefully see yourself in realistic terms, which is positive. You don't get full of yourself that, let's say, a young elite sportsman might be at risk of. But also, you're hopefully more resilient when you are the subject of criticism by others, so that you can take on the constructive criticism, but you can discard the stuff that is malicious, you know?
Yeah, and you can work out when you're wrong and they might be right. So I love that image.
Absolutely.
So you talked about you're on a couple of company boards, you're a leadership in medicine. So what do you see as the common threads that optimism weaves through leadership in medicine, governance, and ethics?
I think it's about identification and prosecution of values, Victor. I think that's part of my reputation, that people know that I'm likely to speak without fear or favour on issues that I believe to be right. And on those, I'm not going to be particularly concerned about what the opinion polls say. To use an example, I ended up as probably the most prominent voice against the legalisation of voluntary assisted dying. I think I was misrepresented on many occasions about that. People questioning my motives, and personal attack, because it's a highly emotive issue. But I am comfortable and remain in those beliefs and the positions that I hold on that, for a range of reasons. But again, you know, it I think I understand why a big majority of the population are so supportive of it. And I wonder if it's because I can see better ways of doing things that they can't, or that death and the end of life, which is something that so much of society is quarantined from or incredibly fearful of, is something that I deal with on a professional basis pretty much every day. So, and again, that experience and knowledge of death helps me to, at least I believe, understand how to approach that in a humane, compassionate, celebratory way, and also to live life to the fullest as well. So having the values and continually trying to discern what those values are, the principles are perennial, but the application of them matters, particularly as science and technology keep giving us the ability to do things that were unimaginable not so long ago. And then how to progress those discussions with the affected stakeholders.
Yes, in looking in federal public policy, we look sometimes at the question of organ donation. And I often say to the students, just imagine being the surgeon that has to have the conversation with the family whose child has just died or whose spouse has just died. And, you and your colleagues, as you say, you experience it, if not every day, at least several times a week. So it must be quite profound. How do you use prayer or meditation? How do you get yourself through all those tough conversations? Oh, I've lost you. You've gone mute.
Oh,
Oh,
am
there
I
you
still here?
are. Yep.
All right. It must have been something with the online, but I heard everything you said there. I look forward to those because I think in many ways that's the time when I'm really doing the essence of what I do, which is being with people at some of the most profound, traumatic, visceral times of their life. And my job is for them to understand me being someone who hopefully knows what he's doing, and who cares deeply for them, who would treat them like I would want someone in my own family or myself treated. And sometimes I say those things. And so there's all sorts of aspects of that that I've learned from experience, from people who have been my teachers and colleagues. I've learned from mistakes, and I've learned from the evidence. To use one example, if I can sit down with someone, the patient and the family think I'm spending a lot more time and taking them more seriously than if I'm standing above them. The very way I introduce myself, that idea of building rapport, some of the elderly, not many now, but some prefer Mrs. Smith or Mrs. Stathiopoulos or something like that, Dr. Parnas. Now, but in most circumstances, it's Stephen or Steve or whatever. I got rapport with a grumpy old bugger the other day who was in his 60s because he had the cricket on as we were introducing ourselves to each other. And I spent 5 minutes talking about the cricket, the Indians, who he thought was going to win, what he thought were the strengths and weaknesses. And I could see that we were on that wavelength. The first year doctor who was with me recording was sort of looking a bit perplexed, saying, "Why is he emphasizing this? We've got a busy round. There's so much to do." But I know that this patient had presented difficulties for my medical and nursing colleagues before me. And if I built some confidence with him, I was going to be able to draw on that capital when I needed to explain some tough realities to him in about 10 minutes after that. I know when people are under enormous duress that they're less likely to recall things. So if I've said to someone, "Dad has a life-threatening illness," or "Dad has a stroke," or something like that, there's a good chance they're not going to pick much up after that. I'll normally go in with someone else if I can. One, because there are times I have to run outside if I'm leading the department or have to go to resus or whatever. But also to try and make sure that people aren't feeling disrespected or ignored. Sometimes it's the messenger, not the message. So I'll be able to do something with, if the patient is Maltese or Italian, there's a bloody good chance I'm going to be able to get there because I speak Maltese, I speak a reasonable amount of Italian. I instinctively understand those cultures very well. But if it's a Muslim woman or something like that, it might be that if I've got a female colleague, she might be more appropriate. Or if I need to touch them for the purposes of examination, that they are fully aware and I don't just do it. Or if I greet them, it's not with the hand shaken out, it's with the hand here as a greeting and a bow. So cultural sensitivity conveys respect and empathy, and talking complex things through without using jargon, Lord knows. Many professions do it, medicine does too, and it's helpful in certain circumstances for precision, but it's very unhelpful if it increases the buffer between doctor and patient. Some people in other professions too use jargon as a way of trying to sound good. But, there's the odd occasion where someone has the presence to honestly say, "What does that acronym mean?" And they can't answer. Now, so the point of communication is that a message is conveyed. You can need an interpreter even if you speak the same language. So helping people understand things, sharing decisions with them. Again, most of the time I am there to recommend a course of action, but by virtue of my expertise and experience, I hold enormous power, and I want people to know that these decisions are not theirs alone to carry on their shoulders. Issues around goals of care. Do we try to do chest compressions on a frail 85-year-old, or do we keep them comfortable and allow nature to take its course? How you share that information is important because I've seen people carry horrible misinterpretations of things. I'm the reason my dad died, or the doctor didn't do enough, because of a misunderstanding at a time. So these are just some anecdotes, Victor, but I think that these are, if you like, some of the most satisfying times to help people when they are with all their layers peeled off under enormous stress, thinking about things that cause them awful grief, and their every instinct is to deny and run away.
I love the strength of what you say in just the small talk, you know, that the young doctor was confused that you would take the time to talk about the cricket, spelling out the acronyms that people don't understand in meetings. So that level of empathy is sensational. So if I could maybe return to something you raised early up about burnout, and you were very public in saying
Yeah.
you're going to take some time off to deal with burnout. And of course, as you know, the workers' compensation system, under the former Premier Daniel Andrews, legislation was introduced to remove the claim of burnout as a long-term workers' compensation issue. So, can you tell us a little bit more about that experience of burnout and what you would recommend to people in terms of trying to avoid burnout, but also acknowledging when it's there?
There are so many different aspects, but to use two very disparate examples, one was I even used that example as a teaching opportunity. I wanted people to understand that admitting to personal frailty, I hope, is a sign of strength, not weakness. Certainly, I've not ever seen that disadvantage me, being myself. In terms of my reputation or my professional development or those sorts of things. But also, I think preparation and good decision making, even in the early stages of one's life and career, is important to reduce these risks. My son, for example, is just about to start, he's 22, he's about to start a master's degree in teaching. He's been a wonderfully gifted student, topped Victoria in a couple of subjects in year 12, but has always been a nurturing, empathetic soul. And he wants to be a secondary school teacher, and I think he'll be wonderful at it. So doing what you love is important, understanding why you do it, recognizing the tweaks that we have to make. Now, when you're passionate and enthusiastic about things, you want to be involved and do things. The flip side of that is you can probably take on too much. And certainly for the years 20 and 21, I had more on my plate than probably I'd ever had before. Three hospitals, which is probably too much for most emergency physicians. The public policy and media stuff was important, but I was best situated to do that. That happened by accident as well. Speaking to people in senior leadership roles, usually in private, because that's how you get the best things done rather than publicly where people have to save face. But I started realizing that I was getting irritable with the people I loved, that decisions were getting harder, and probably most significantly, my ability to draw on compassion and empathy for people, particularly the patients, but also the people around me, that was getting harder and harder to find. I think I was a bit more emotionally labile as well. And I'd seen this in some colleagues, but recognizing it in myself and having the support of the right people, my wife is a doctor, my GP, my psychologist, and you know, my father, trusted people in my family and friends. They were all worried and concerned, and I needed that professional support to say, okay, I need some time off. And when the GP said, I think you need 3 months off, I'd never had 3 months off before. So, you know, doing that was a good thing. And so sharing that with others, and for me, that's therapeutic as well, because it helps me clarify my thinking. And I hope it also means that I can mentor and support others who may be making decisions about career, about work-life balance. And again, I'm in that luxurious of positions where I can have a lot of say over the hours I work, where I work, and what motivates me now, what gives me real satisfaction might be different to what I did 20 years ago. So helping people understand that stuff. And if you prepare people, they're going to be better at it, whether it's a career or an operation, or any other adverse issue. So again, it's that product of personal experience, trying to think it through, being careful about the advice you seek, because there are a lot of well-meaning people out there, even experts, who say exactly the wrong thing. And trying to make gentle steps in the right direction.
That clarity of purpose, as you say, and being able to test that with people like your father and colleagues and your wife and, 22-year-old sons, mine's 19, they're able to, they watch you closer than anyone else in the world. So they're great sources of advice. Can I take you to that connection between optimism and health? And for instance, Carol Graham at Brookings Institute quite early up talked about the connection between optimism and healthy longevity. Harvard, the American Heart Association have all said that optimism is protective against cancer, against heart disease, against dementia, and in the first two, predictive of recovery under treatment. So what do you see, in the course of your work, and how can we best foster that knowledge? So I've done a bit of work, for instance, with the cardiologists at Ipswich Hospital and the like in training their staff to teach their staff to be more optimistic. So how do you deal with that connection between optimism and good health and optimism and that question of recovery?
Again, so many aspects to this, and it's a question of where do you place your emphasis? I think society in general is trying to do this. You hear the word wellness all the time. Now, I see some wonderfully sensible, practical approaches to that, and I see some rubbish as well. Buy this bottle of this stuff for a ridiculous price and you'll be well. The shopping supermarket market aisle where there's a little section called health, and I laughed to one of the kids and I said, "Let's go buy some health." My experience is most profoundly from the examples of those whom I encounter, often in a professional sense, but often in just other areas of my life. When you see people, so let's talk about patients. The patients who, get to be 80, 90. I saw an old lady yesterday who I've known since I was a kid. She's 91 now. She looks 80. She's mentally very sharp. She's got a lovely sort of, what's the word, fatalistic approach to various things. I saw her at a lunch yesterday, and she's got a walker and had to go up the steps on one of those mechanized lifting things. And she said, "Look at this bloody machine I have to use these days, but it's better than being carried up." But again, that happy, contented temperament, without being, the happy, clappy types. It was really very, I'm enjoying my time and what I do. And she was a teacher. And retired long ago, but still teaches in other ways. The married couples who have been married for, the record I've got is 73 years. One partner's in the bed, the other's sitting beside them. They sit with each other, they finish each other's sentences. There's a level of communication between them that is beyond sensory. I'm now confident and experienced enough to say, I honor that. This is amazing stuff because it's an education to everyone around them. The people who have the positive view, even in the settings where others might be devastated. Palliative care, where the goal is symptom relief, but they know the disease is not curable. These are patients who are often interested in asking how you are. Who are so quick at the first opportunity to say, gee, thanks for the care I'm getting. Aren't I so fortunate that I'm getting this or that? That's amazing stuff because you walk away from a consultation with those people and you want to pay them, not the other, not get the bill, if you not give them a bill. Not that I get one anyway. I love the fact that I'm salaried. So from the patients and the families, I had a patient with severe cerebral palsy the other day with a bony injury, and his sister, the patient's in his 50s. The sister and two carers, you could see how well they know him and care for him and love him. And I make it my business to acknowledge that and say again to that poor early doctor who was getting all of these platitudes from me that day, were saying, this is one of those cases where the patient gets better care at home than they could ever get in hospital. So those attitudes and those examples, and it's more about what they do rather than what they say. And then my colleagues, I know a colleague who's in his mid-60s. They say that emergency medicine is a young person's game, and in some respects it is. Night shifts, shift work, the go, the chaos. The cliche is, the 30-year-old George Clooney type. But this fellow has been doing it for longer than I have, and yet he still comes across as one of the younger members because he loves what he does. He's seen the other side or other aspects of this. He understands the settings in which our system works. He's good at teaching. He's good at recognizing his limitations, as well as what he's really good at. Happy to take on new things, but also if something works, it's good. With a sense of irony, he's happy to, with me at least, as someone who knows the system and has been around a long time, comment on the changes in health system politics and administration and the like and say, okay, what's better than it was 30 years ago and what isn't? What has deteriorated? But not in a way that it's going to make him burst an aneurysm, more as a way of saying, okay, now how do we deal with this? And what is within our scope of control and what isn't? So, they're profound and powerful examples, I think. And for me, having someone like him around is important because most of the staff have been around less than me. Now, that's the other thing, this idea that the transfer of knowledge or wisdom or skills or energy, that is all one directional from senior to junior, that's rubbish. It's actually a two-way thing. I draw something from the enthusiasm, novelty, and anticipation that the younger doctors have. For example, I mean, the interns who have just graduated are starting work yesterday, today. And I always think about when I was in that situation in 1993. And I take joy from their experience, but I also know how important it is for me as a senior doctor to be a calming, grounding, reassuring influence for them. So back to the summary of it, I think everyone I encounter, you can get a sense of young people who have wisdom, have made good choices, have the ability to deal with unexpected things that have landed on their lap. Those who suffer what looks like serious adversity, who are able to still display empathy, concern for others, and gratitude for what they do have, and knowing that they preach their sermon through the way they behave and act rather than really what they say or do. So, we keep getting those those examples on a daily basis, all of us, not just people who work in a hospital, for example.
Yeah, no, that positivity. So years and years ago, I chaired an inquiry into the legal liability of medical practitioners. And I was very conscious here. People had given up, for instance, GPs had stopped delivering babies, for instance, because of not necessarily the amount of the insurance premium, but just the worry about litigation and reputational risk. So, in your role at Medical Insurance Group Australia, how do you support practitioners managing that fear and anxiety of legal liability, of litigation, of reputational risk?
I should insert the video I did to the membership just before Christmas, actually. I feel like a broken record, but repetition's important on these things. There's a whole number of areas, but as chairman of the board now, and I've been doing that for a year, I think there are important messages to say to the membership, the medical profession, to government, to the staff, to my board colleagues. Things like there is no such thing as no risk, that the best decisions are made when you have that balance between caution and confidence. If someone is overconfident, they will make mistakes. If they are too cautious, they'll be paralyzed by indecision and won't, and potentially be just as unhelpful or risky as well. To recognize that they have the capacity to do enormous good because they do important things, and they should savor the vast majority of circumstances where they do make a really positive difference, and that is more important than the paycheck. That quest for excellence without perfection. Again, I summarize it as medical personality disorder. I think we're all perfectionists. We all take responsibility for things, even the things that we're not responsible for. We are our own harshest critics, that the first thing to do in the provision of basic life support is not look at the A for airway, but the D for dangers. And dangers is a way of saying self-care. You need to make sure that you are not professionally isolated. We work in teams because no one's got a monopoly on knowledge. It is not a shift goes by where I don't ask for advice from colleagues, where doing things as a team gets the best results. That's almost without question. And just reapplying and repeating these measures to people, but also to help them understand the system, the duress that you go under when you are the subject of a complaint is huge. I say that doctors regard their reputations a little bit like the way they regard their children, absolutely precious to them. That almost prefer to take a bullet than see it or them subject to attack. That they need help and support and expertise and care of others as well. And so, again, emphasizing that the staff of my company are experienced, that they deeply respect what doctors do, that they are caring and supportive. We've got a phone that's there for 24 hours in the day, so that if a doctor can't sleep because they've got a cold sweat about a bad letter or something, that they're going to have a compassionate expert listening ear. And also, I think, to try and improve the system so that we can, I suppose, reduce vexatious complaints, that we can help people understand what the purpose of the legal system is, what its shortcomings are. Mediation is always better than a confrontational approach in court, that there are things that you can do to minimize the chances of being subject to these things, but sometimes it's out of your control. And you can document well, you can debrief with colleagues, you can keep looking to improve on things, that people judge you as a doctor, not necessarily by the way that your colleagues judge you. Some people judge a doctor by whether they drive a prestige vehicle or not. And I think they'd be pretty disappointed with me. I got a bicycle. I remember the reception I got when I drove the bicycle into the president's car park at the AMA. Some people were, the ground was shaking. So I suppose that point is that the only way to eliminate risk is to eliminate activity. You can minimize risk. You can avoid professional isolation. You can take care of yourself, and you can recognize your limitations as an individual. If you do all of those things, there's a pretty good chance you're going to have a long and rewarding career and make a lot of people better.
Oh, that's brilliant. It's good that you are chair of that company, that with those wonderful attitudes. Coming back to your comment earlier about you're very good at looking at the best of things, and you talked about new technology. So what are you seeing? I mean, I got an email yesterday that said all blokes my age should be getting their hands dirty with AI. And I do have my own ChatGPT who advises me. What are you seeing, in emergency medicine? Is AI coming to bear to help you? What are the new things you're seeing to make your practice even better?
Well, AI has been around for a few more years than most people think. It's just that it reached a critical point maybe a year or two ago where it sort of became more front of mind for most people and was starting to do certain things that really caught people's attention and raised eyebrows and stayed in the memory. For example, robotic assisted surgery, which might reduce human tremor. That allows potentially, with the right training, better outcomes for the patient. This is not an area that I deal with. I'm not a surgeon, but I know that that has the capacity to make a difference for people. Endoscopy, so doing gastroscopy and colonoscopy for people, AI increases the pickup rate of suspicious lesions by maybe 5%, something like that. And that's been around for quite a few years. The idea of artificial intelligence assisting with documentation. The lawyers in my medical indemnity company are now starting to use AI to provide transcripts of consultations with other legal parties or with doctors or whatever. All of these things have the capacity to save time, improve efficiency. If I spend less time, and I could spend up to half my time entering data, things like that, and I'm able to spend more of that with patients and colleagues, then I suspect I'd be a lot happier and certainly a lot more efficient. But it's about knowing where those opportunities are, but also knowing where the risks are. Now, this may not always be the case. I hesitate to ever say anything set in concrete on these things, but AI is best in healthcare contexts when it sits beside the human clinician. It's a point of checking, it gives advice, but it doesn't make the final decisions and it doesn't carry the final responsibility. For example, AI has the capacity to hallucinate. To make things up that aren't ex that don't exist. An example: a person who had an MRI of their brain. Two radiologists looked at it and said, "This is normal." The patient put it through an AI program, and it said, "You've got a brain tumor." She, unsurprisingly, took it back to the radiology service. Three other radiologists had a look. Can't see anything. Can't do that. It looks normal. This is good news. The stakes are high here, isn't it? It's not just about that person's well-being. It's about, are they missing anything important? If someone went on to do a more invasive test, those things carry risks. Allergic reactions to contrast, taking a sample of a tissue can result in bleeding, infection. So the ethical principles that were around from the time of Hippocrates are still applicable here. Am I respecting patient autonomy? Talking through the options. Am I first? Do no harm. So even doing a test like a CAT scan on a child, which increases their risk of malignancy long after you're gone, is that justifiable in this circumstance? Versus efficiency, even things like teaching opportunities for people. They all provide opportunities. One example that's closer to home for me is the use of ultrasound. Ultrasound's been around a very long time. But point of care ultrasound, where you can pull a probe out of your pocket, use your mobile phone as the screen, and put this on the patient's tummy to look for free fluid in their abdomen in the setting of trauma. That's already here. It was the stethoscope when I was an intern, but the stethoscope's been around 200 years. It's really more to identify me as a doctor on TV or just out of force of habit these days. The ultrasound's doing more. But I know that my younger colleagues who are learning it from day one are always going to be better at it than I am, who was starting to learn it 25 years after graduation. So it's the training, it's the evidence behind it, it's the quality controls. So this is where bureaucratic systems are important. The Therapeutic Goods Administration is important for medical devices. There are many companies out there looking to start up, to innovate, to do things in healthcare, which is great. They bring enormous resources that public sector may not have, an efficiency and a drive in research development that wasn't there before. But again, understanding where the ethical and practical breaks need to take place, that's important too. So it's a long answer, but I hope it sort of demonstrates to people that technology can be very, very helpful, but it can also be dangerous if used in the wrong way.
Exactly. I used to have a next door neighbour who specialised in prostate surgery, and he had the first of the robotic device. He always said, better to use this than my fat fingers. So I always remember that as his touch of humour in that. Look, you see a lot of people, not just at work, but in terms of your advocacy and the like. And one of the things that troubles me and our work at the Centre for Optimism is the evidence that Australians still generally remain optimistic for themselves and their families, but they're increasingly pessimistic about the country and the world. So in terms of your public policy work and, you know, the conversations you're hearing from both colleagues and patients, do you reckon that that data is true? And, you know, are there any ways we can turn it around?
I think it's almost a bit like turning a tanker around. It takes a long time and enormous forces to change directions, but it's not one single trigger. It's millions of small efforts in the right direction, even if there is attempts at pushback in the opposite direction. There is enormous uncertainty, probably from in my lifetime at a global level, enormous uncertainty. The impacts of climate change, to use one example, is a profound one. And unfortunately, we have seen so often the instinctive human reaction to deny or push back like a cornered animal or a selfish approach to just become introspective to respond to these things rather than look at it from an evidence base, from recognising where there is expertise, working out what can be done both at a small level in terms of personal, household or corporate behaviour, all the way through to a COP meeting, and how we take those setbacks on board and deal with it. The rise in what I would regard as, I suppose, far-right politics, those extreme populists who do have, I think, scant regard for truth, who know how to curry favour by pointing out either shortcomings, adverse outcomes, being happy to take credit for things that have nothing to do with them. And then almost inevitably disappointing people if and when they gain the reins of power, and not being willing to play by rules. Now, there is a place for disruption, but rules are sometimes, well, not sometimes, they are often there for safety's sake. And if you break the rules, you've got to know what you're doing. And it's very uncommon to do that. Maybe one example where I break rules is I speak to the media frequently. But if anyone's going to do it, I think I can because I've been doing it for over 20 years. If there's been a mistake made, I've probably made it. I've had a lot of training, and I know how I've got a pretty good sense of where to go and where not to go. I say no as often as I say yes to those things. So that's that global picture. There is that uncertainty and that tendency to despair. I think we take those things on where we can, but measure the dose. I still think, in terms of social media, Twitter or X has a real value, but it can be a cesspit. The behavior demonstrated there is something that we wouldn't accept in any other circumstance. And so backing off from that sometimes, to almost wash yourself and come back a bit healthier and happier is important. I think in terms of the people around us, I think we've got an obligation to empower, protect where possible, but respect them as well, because in some ways they're the custodians of the future. We have a role to play and look there and learn from the past. But an anecdote from yesterday, I have an uncle in his mid-80s who was saying some of the most depressing things to my son, who's the 22-year-old. And I said to him in a gentle but chiding sense to my uncle, I said, there are more positive and important things to say to the future generation, and that they have more positivity. The world wasn't just good back in 1965. It had its problems too. It's how we address these things. And so I find, my relationship with my kids, and they're 16 to 24, has evolved. It's not the laying down the law, it's two-way. And I want and try to understand what are the priorities that they have as well. What do they see as important? This argument about climate change that we all had to endure for the first decade of this century and even into the second decade, that's a no-brainer for them. A lot of the conflicts that they see around the world, again, they see those things in much clearer terms than older people do. And not in a black and white usual, oh, you're young, you oversimplify things. They have a wisdom of their own as well. And I try to resist that temptation at this stage in my life to talk down to them. Their perspectives, their expertise is far better than some would give them credit for. And that's why having diversity of leadership, and diversity includes age, not just gender, education, ethnicities. Age is a very important marker of diversity as well. That gives us better outcomes too. I am wary, but I suppose my thought about the future is one of determination, I think. I'm sort of girding the loins to see what the next few years bring. I hope and will try whatever I can do in my own small ways to present the values that I think are important. And if I can oversimplify, my philosophy is that us is more important than me. And me leads to sadness, inadequacy, depression, insecurity, whereas us brings out that fulfillment, that joy, that sense of gratification that as social beings we have as humans.
Yeah, joy is so important, just to experience it. Last year I did a project with a Finnish organization called The Art and Science of Joy. And it has so changed my life in the sense that every time I pass a rose bush, I do stop and smell the rose. I glorify in the sunrises and the sunsets. So, and I love that thing you said that it's the millions of decisions because, last year we helped to get into the Commonwealth Heads of Government communique the need to foster optimism in the young. Now our battle is to actually make them do something about it, not just to concede that it's important. Now, we've nearly reached the hour mark, and I always promise our listeners we're not going to go much beyond the hour. So may I ask you the last question? What advice would you give to someone struggling to find optimism today, whether in healthcare or another walk of life? What are your tips and tricks for remaining optimistic?
It's an interesting thing. We all have periods in our life where things look bleaker than at others. But I think the answer to that is slow down, remove a lot of the noise that is there. There's so much of it in our world. So find some stillness, look for things that are beautiful. And it might just be if you open a window, it might just be if you, say hello to someone on the phone or in person. Let that beauty seep in and reflect on it. And that'll, I think, point you in the right direction. So remove the noise, look for beauty. And beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Some people find beauty in a beautifully polished up vintage car. Other people find it, I find it in the wilderness. I find it in seeing a young person achieve their potential. I see it in the love between a husband and wife who've been together for 65 years. All of these things. I see beauty when someone says, "I'm sorry, I did the wrong thing." Doing that, and I reckon it won't take long before there is some positive that comes your way. And if even if that's a struggle, try and share that sadness, the bleakness with someone else, and you will feel better. I've never seen a person yet who hasn't felt better for sharing something tough with someone who cares.
Well, Stephen, you are the model of an infectiously optimistic Australian leader, and I'm sure much of your success is owed to that, as well as to your parents and family and friends and colleagues. So, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, connecting the dots for us, sharing your experiences, and sharing your optimism.
It's an honor to spend some time with you, Victor. Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed that fascinating and inspiring conversation with Dr. Stephen Parnas. His reflections on optimism, leadership, and resilience offer much food for thought and practical wisdom. If you'd like to stay connected with Dr. Parnas, you can follow him on LinkedIn and X, the platform formerly known as Twitter. And you're always welcome to stay in touch with me, Victor Perton, that optimism man, as well. You can join us through our website at the Centre for Optimism. And you can follow me, Victor Perton, on X, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Substack. I'd love to hear your comments and thoughts on this episode and what else you'd like to hear on that Optimism Man podcast. Until next time, stay optimistic and keep spreading the joy of positivity.